horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back. 10 minutes into hour two, and looking forward to a more vocally able Rich Migliori after he clearly lost his mind and his voice in the Rangers overtime series winning effort on Sunday night. Mig, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Just bear with me 1 second because I got a horse in each hand, but I'll be free in about 10 seconds. Give me one. No, it was awesome. All right, don't run off now. There you go. Yep. I'm free.
This is
sorry.
Life on the farm. Life on the farm. I love it.
Yeah. I didn't know if I was coming on with you for sure or not. That's why I figured I'd reach out. But I got the horses all turned out. I'm in good shape now.
Very nice.
It was great. Unbelievable game. Unbelievable game. Best hockey game I've ever been to because obviously my team won. But Jay Oringer, who owns Petey Bianchi, took me. And he's really good friends with Adam Fox's dad, who plays for the Rangers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he likes the races a lot, Bruce Fox, a lot. So it was fun. It was a really good time. Still not 100% my voice, but I'm okay.
No, you sound good, and you'll certainly be back to full strength, sort of like a power play, back to full strength for TV.
Yeah, Thursday. Well, that's why it worked out good. It was a Sunday night, right? Because I knew I was going to go nuts. And then when they won, Steve, you're hugging perfect strangers. This big guy picked me up. He must have been 300 pounds. He lifted me over his head. I was like, it was pandemonium.
I love it. I love it. I've been in a few of those scenes. I can imagine. If the Sabres ever get good again, I'd love to experience that. We also, you've had a bunch of reasons to celebrate. I don't know if you were busy this morning, but we had Trevor. I promised that I was going to get Trevor on to visit to congratulate him on his grade one.
Yeah, that was a big, big time win. So happy for him and my son, Joe. And, you know, what's interesting is Trevor rides so good, and it takes wins like that for people to really recognize it. That's the kind of races that get you to the next level, you know? And in hindsight, because the horse got annihilated at the break the time before, and the race, it was much too short a distance for him, that's a horse that, you know, way, way too big a price.
We talked to Graham yesterday, too, and it's funny that a horse like this could sneak up on people. And I guess it just was a question of, you know, the reputation of Yabir and Gaffoe. Then I think if people thought that there was going to be an alternative narrative, it would be a ban wiring the field somehow. But that's why Trevor's ride was so clever.
Well, you know, putting the horse in the race, and that's one of Trevor's strengths, is recognizing how a race, you know, potentially is going to unfold. He does his work. You know, I talk about preparation all the time, and it goes deeper than just looking at a racing form. It's just really having a feel for the competition and understanding what you need to do, like him wanting to put some separation between him and the real closers before the quarter pole. Because, you know, I talk about it all the time. You hold up and wait on horses that have a kick. In essence, your strategy becomes, I'm going to out-kick the kickers. It just doesn't work. So him understanding and putting that separation, and, it was tremendous. I was just so, so thrilled for them. And, you know, everything's confidence. Like, you know, they had such a good aqueduct, and then get to Belmont, and you know, things didn't get off as fast as they would have liked, but a win like that puts you right where you need to be confidence-wise.
Well, and when it comes to a career curve, you can maybe touch on this. We talked about the move to New York, and you know there was that sort of fishtail's not the right word. There was that experiment, the going out to California, but it feels like. Now he's into a real flow. You know, what does it do? He's what, 31, 32 probably now. You know, what does it do for a rider when you get a grade one like this? And you know, how much? You know, obviously it's a milestone, but is there more to it than that? Is there a greater value? On a wider basis, like you talked about awareness and people, you know, watching a race like that and saying, you know, Jesus, this guy can really ride.
Well, yeah, I mean that's the obvious. That's what's immediate, that people, you know, pay closer attention to bigger races. They do. I mean, you could win. You know, I remember one year I won 11 races opening week at Belmont. I went 11 for 22 opening week, 50%. And it didn't have the impact that you would think it might, because they were just still everyday races, and they're just as hard to win, and we all know how difficult it is to win races. But you would think 11 for 22 would catch attention. But then, you know, go to Saratoga and win the grade one, you know, the Ballerina, and that gets way more, you know, I don't want to say publicity, but certainly gets a lot more noticed. And so you got to win those races. You've got to win big races for people to think of you in that light. That hey, we're not going to hesitate. I've got a horse in a big race. This guy can win a big race. And then on a personal note, as a jockey, knowing that you can win at that level, you know,
right?
We can all walk around with a lot of bravado and say, yeah, I know I'm as good as anybody else. But until you win grade ones, until you win bigger races. You still kind of got to prove it to yourself that almost like for me, it was like, am I worthy? You know, am I, like, I'm not one of those guys. I'm a guy from Brooklyn. This was my thought process when I was young. You know, I'm just like, you know, thrilled to be in the show, right? But then when you win them, you realize like, hey, wait a second, I'm just as deserving as the next guy. Why shouldn't I? Just because, you know, maybe my journey wasn't as conventional as some of them, didn't mean I didn't get there. So I think, you know, Trevor probably is feeling like right now, like, hey, man, yeah, I can win grade ones. I can win triple crown races. Because that's what it does for you. It builds a confidence. And again, not like this swaggering around confidence, just like, hey, yeah, I know how to get it done. I see the roadmap now. And listen, his work ethic is second to none. I've been out a lot of mornings recently, and he just gets on horse after horse after horse, which is so reminiscent of his father, Mike. Mike would work as hard as anybody you ever saw in the mornings, and, you know, living testimony to me that if you want to do something bad enough, you figure out a way to get it done. That he embodied that, his dad, and, you know, he passed that on to his son, because Trevor has the same work ethic.
I started down one path with him, and you know, I think about. I didn't realize until he said it. I mean, 10 years he's been riding, and I remember when he started, and we talked about. You know, he would have nightly conversations. He said with his father. Well, now Rich, he's got his dad. He's got his wife. He's got his brother and sister-in-law. He's got his father-in-law. He's got you. So I told him there's like a half jury that basically are, you know, tell him everything he did wrong when he doesn't win.
Yeah, but you know, it's just as important too to tell him what he did right when he didn't win. Like he rode a race the other day on the grass, and he got stuck. I mean, it just, you know, one of those races where it just didn't open up. And I know what it's like when that happens. You're so frustrated in the moment that you don't see that you actually did everything right. You just got unlucky. There's a big difference between a bad ride and an unlucky ride. And I was, you know, Paddock, I was doing the Paddock reports. And I waited for him down by the stairs back down to the jocks room with Belmont because I know how hard he takes everything. He wants to be perfect. And I said to him, hey, you know you rode a good race there, right? And he goes, yeah, because I got trapped. I said, no. I said, you ride that race on the turf, and you're going to win 90% of the time with that trip, and you're going to give horses a better opportunity to win. So, you know, just we can't be so result-oriented all the time that, you know, when you win, it's a good ride. When you lose, it's a bad ride. You ride the turf. You fight for the inside, get to the inside, try to follow live cover. That's how you win turf races. Turf racing, you know, there's much less separation from the first horse to the last horse. You know, a horse wins by open lengths on the turf, he's dominant. A lot of those races, you could throw a blanket over the field. So what does that tell you? It tells you about trip, about, you know, saving ground and not riding a horse like, you know, I'm best, I'm going to be three or four wide. It's something we worked with Dylan a great deal with, Dylan Davis. You know, about the 5/16 pole, 3/8 pole, he was looking to get to the outside, not from what people like to, you know, talk nonsense that don't know, oh, a rider's afraid to be inside. Not afraid from a physical risk or that, like, you're going to get hurt, that you're afraid of the criticism that's going to come if, in fact, you do get trapped. And Dylan would have ride a great race up until the 5/16 pole, and then he'd be looking to go right when the race is going forward. And just talking to him about it, constantly reinforcing, no, stay in there. Find the horse you need to follow. Find your fullback. You're the halfback. Find your fullback that's going to carry you through the line, make the gaps for you. And now you see how disciplined he is about it. And Trevor's that way, too. He's disciplined about it. That's how you win turf races. And you can't let it shake you when it doesn't work out, because that's, you know, one out of 20 isn't going to work out.
Well, he's obviously got a lot of things to look forward to. You know, one of the other parts of the curve or the career arc, Rich, and I hated to, I realized the minute I started to bring it up, I said, ugh, I shouldn't have said this, but he has managed to avoid the injury bug because he had a real bad spate where he must have gotten hurt, I'm going to guess, 3 times in 4 years, 5 years, that really seemed to inhibit his career development.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a tricky thing to talk about, isn't it? Like, you know, riders, I'll tell you a funny story just to how riders think about this stuff, but particularly when you have injuries in bunches, because, you know, my first few injuries were bad injuries, but they were spaced pretty well apart in the beginning. Later in the career, they came in bunches again. But if you have time to rebuild your business, because when you're out for 2 months or more, you lose all your horses, basically. Yeah, you're going to get some of them back, but you know the ones you're going to get back? The ones that haven't been winning or running well, because trainers and owners are reluctant to take guys off of horses that they've had success with.
Sure.
So you're basically rebuilding. You're basically starting. Now, that doesn't mean you don't have support and you don't have people that are going to step up to the plate and help you out. I was always very fortunate that way. You know, from going back to Pete Ferriola promising me when I was still in a halo, he was going to put me on my first winner back. You know, Michael Hushin and Barry Schwartz, John Kimmel, Kieran McLaughlin. You know, you have people that are definitely, but it's still tricky. They've got to work you back into the rotation. So when you go through 3 or 4 injuries in a close proximity and that rebuilding stage is so dominant, it's just really hard to get back to the position that you work to get to. And that's why, you know, injuries derail riders, you know, so much when they come in, you know, 3 or 4 in a row where you just don't have time to, you know, a kid that really top rider that's had way too many injuries, Sheldon Russell, you know, which, again, constantly having him to rebuild and start his career over, jumpstart it again. And obviously dealing with all the other things, you know, getting 100% physically, getting 100% mentally, getting your timing back, getting your confidence back. It's just so difficult. It's it's not a team sport. You see hockey players get hurt. There's a trainer, a coach, three or four different coaches. There's team doctors. There's teammates. That's not the way it is with a jockey. It's a pretty lonely existence in a lot of respects. You have your immediate support system around you, but it's not like you have a team that's helping you get back to where you need to be. I spent 6 weeks in LAJ the first time I broke my neck and got out. I was going to a rehab hospital. We hired a private ambulance to take me up to Westchester to a rehab hospital, which I spent another month. And I convinced the ambulance driver to take me to Belmont because I had no memory of ever leaving Belmont the day of the accident. I didn't have a memory of going to the jocks room that morning, and it just was important to me. I wanted to see a race. So we drove to the back of Belmont, and they used to have the big hedges, and the gate crew is there, and Bobby Duncan and all the guys, that I grew up around, helped me out of the ambulance, come through the break in the hedge. I've got a walker. I'm all, I looked a wreck, and I couldn't talk because they had gone through the front of my throat, and I see there's like Eddie Maple, and there's Angel Cordero, and George Vasquez, Jacinto, and I'm like, hey, guys, hey. And they like looked at me and looked away and kept jogging around, and the race broke, and I whispered like, wow, nobody was happy to see me, like I was hurt. And they all busted out laughing. Oh, yeah, I want to look over and see you and go, that can happen to me, and then break out of the gate. So riders don't like to look at that stuff. They don't want to, face that hard reality that is a possibility.
Hey, that's funny. It's we've had these conversations between you and Tony, too. I don't think there's anybody in the last, 50, probably half century, right, that had more career-threatening, right? More injuries that should have ended a career than you did.
Well, like I said, I had some pretty traumatic ones. Like early on, they were spaced far enough apart that, like I said, I could always kind of rebuild and get back in the groove. Later in my career, starting about 2003, it was like I got back riding, and 4 months later, I'm on the ground again. And those just crush your business. And, the fact of the matter is there's younger guys coming along all the time that have a lot of ability. And, I even had a trainer who I had success with say to me, my mantra was, I just want to be in the batting order. I don't care if I'm batting ninth. I just want to be alive in your barn so that I would be eligible to pick up a horse at any time, maybe shipping out of town or whatever it was. And the trainer looked me in the eye and said, listen, why am I going to ride you when I could ride some kid that doesn't have your battle scars? And that just becomes a reality for riders that are getting older and have been beaten up like I was beaten up. But, the spinal injuries are always a very scary thing with riders. But maybe the most challenging injury to come back from was when I broke my arm. And people, you think a broken arm, the horse stepped on my forearm. And, shattered it. They likened the injury, Steve, to getting shot with a high-powered rifle at close range. It completely sheared my radius and ulna. And they had three surgeries, three different bone grafts. I still have 2-plate 16 screws in my forearm. And it was so bad, Lloyd's of London that had my insurance policy, their doctors said it's a career-ending injury. They wanted to buy me out. They wanted to buy out the policy. Carmella made a very compelling presentation, why I didn't need to ride anymore because, the money we were going to get, and I turned it down, and I came back. It took me 7.5 months, and I came back. To my wife's credit, she never brought it up again, which, maybe it would have been smarter, I don't know. But I knew I could still ride. It's just getting that arm back, and next time I see you, I'll show you the difference, one arm to the other. It's never, ever going to be the same, but at least I was able to get it to a point where I could ride. And that was frustrating to me because I was always not very much a physical rider. And I definitely lost a lot of my physicality the last several years of my career. You learn to accommodate and adjust and figure out a way to get by and it strengthens other parts of your game. I became smarter in some respects because I lost some of my physicality, but listen, it's something all riders go through. It just depends on, you know, some guys get very lucky and it's not as severe, and some guys pay the ultimate price. So I know I'm fortunate. I'm not sitting here crying about it.
Well, let's shift and maybe get in a few other notes. I'm going to talk to Andy later, and I'm sure we'll cover also, you know, some of these other stakes. What? How about the return? One thing I haven't talked about yet is the return to action by Bella Sofia, which I thought that's a race from the weekend that I know it went early in the day. Nobody's really paid much attention to that vagrancy result.
It did kind of get lost in the shuffle, didn't it? And what a great horse race. I mean, that's as good a race as you're going to see. Two world-class filly and a top-class mare throwing it down. Frank Charquette got a great trip under Flavian, who, again, continues to open eyes. You know, I think some people might have been of the mindset that, well, he's out in California in the small fields and he's riding good horses. I think they've learned otherwise pretty quickly. The guy puts horses where they need to be and he finishes very, very strong. But it was interesting when Louis, he shifted out and gave Frank Charquette some room. When he brought Bella Sofia back down to her, and people should go back and watch this replay, the last 16th of a mile, you could see her ears pin even harder than they already were. And how she bore down and looked that filly in the eye and like, no, I'm not going to let you get by me. And it's that competitiveness that makes her as good as she is. I mean, obviously, there's always got to be raw talent. But then there has to be will. So you got skill and will, and that's what makes her as great as she is.
Well, and it doesn't look like Rudy and Michael Imperio and the team, they're going to sort of to take a wait and feel kind of approach and let her sort of dictate the path to the Breeders' Cup with her.
Well, yeah. I mean, last year, you think about it, she fit a lot of racing in a short period of time, you know, and took it right to the top level pretty quickly. And, this year as a four-year-old, she should be, you know, a little bit stronger, a little bit tougher, and you know, Breeders' Cup is the ultimate goal. Yeah, the Breeders' Cup is great, obviously, but that's why the Fall Championship Series at Belmont was so great years ago, because it was like three races basically in every category to decide the championship, as opposed to, you know, it was more of a Stanley Cup playoffs as opposed to the Super Bowl.
Now, and we've had this, you know who speaks eloquently on this is Andy about, you know, the Breeders' Cup and how it has become such a monolith that, I mean, to the point of having to move a race like the Jockey Club Gold Cup to keep it, viable. I mean, that's a, you know, an after effect or a unintended consequence of the Breeders' Cup and what it, you know, what it's done to the schedule. And then, of course, you have to overlay the schedule that horses essentially keep these days. I mean, instead of running eight or nine times, they're running five, six times. And it's a different, you know, it's a whole different environment.
Well, how about I was looking at it. I brought the champions book to the office at the track because sometimes you just want to reference something, and it's easy to go back and look it up then. And Forgo runs in the Marlboro Cup, back in the Woodward, which the Woodward was a mile and a half then. In between the Woodward and the Jockey Cup Gold Cup, which was 2 miles then, he ran in the Vosburgh going 7/8. And then he ran. So he used the Vosburgh, going 7/8 to prep for the 2 mile. You know, when will you ever see a horse do anything remotely close to that? You know, basically running every 2 weeks and, you know, carrying high weight and running from 7 furlongs to 2 miles. And that's, you know, you'll never see that. I mean, you won't see horses run 2 miles anymore, hardly. But
yeah, there's maybe two or three of those, even a Gulfstream's got the Allen Jerkins. You know, by the way, since I mentioned that and I brought it up, it came up inadvertently with Graham Motion yesterday, and I made a mental note. I'm glad Allen popped in my head, because that horse that Trevor is riding on Thursday in the first race, I don't know if you noticed this yet, Mrs. Postman, the Pioneer of the Nile, for Len Riggio out of Miss Shop. And I know you rode Miss Shop to at least one stake win.
Yeah, I think I might have won two stakes on her, one on the turf, one on the dirt. She won like... I forget the name of the race. And then she was like second or third maybe in another stake.
Coaching club.
Yeah,
in the mud.
Yeah, I liked her a lot. She was good. I picked her up that day on the turf, and she won
the
that
Castle
day.
Royal. The Castle Royal.
Castle Royal. That's what it was. Yeah, I kept wanting to say Newcastle, and I knew that wasn't right.
That's in Delaware.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I think... you know, that might have been Godolphin's first stake winner in North America under the Godolphin banner was the Newcastle. I won it on a filly named Grafton for Kieran McLaughlin. I remember me and Neil went down there. It was like a $50,000 stake. We took a helicopter, and you know, because I rode earlier in the day at Belmont, and we're circling around because there was supposed to be a windsock. And that's where they told the pilot to put the helicopter down, and we couldn't find the windsock. And, like, I'm looking at the watch. I got to get in the jock's room. I'm going to lose his mouth. And I'm telling the pilot, just like, there's a field. Just put it down there. Like, we could see the track. I'll run. Like, you know, and he put it down in the field, and here come police. And everything. Like, we were in the wrong place, but I made it to the jock's room. The police actually drove me to the jock's room, and then she won. And that was Godolphin's first North American stake win. It was a little stake, I believe, the Newcastle at Delaware. And then you brought up the vagrancy. You know, you lead me to places. So when I was a kid, galloping horses for Steve DeMauro, we had this older exercise rider from Aiken, Teddy, and he could always get his horses to gallop off the bridle, like the toughest horses. And then when he would, like, snug them up and put the bit in their mouth, that's when they would jump on it and work. And I was so intrigued by it, and I asked him, Teddy, how do you do this? And he explained to me how, when they're babies, how you teach them. So a filly named Island Charm comes in, and I'm assigned her, and from the start, I'm teaching her to be off the bridle, and she got a mouth like butter because of it. And then when you would breeze her, you'd put the bit up in her mouth, and it would, like, you know, clear the runway. So I'm the only person to ever gallop her my... You know, as a kid, well, I started riding. Jeffrey Fell had ridden her. Eddie Maple had ridden her. She won three or four races at Hialeah. And she came up to New York, and they put me on in an allowance race. So I get to ride this filly that I've been basically galloping for 2 years. And she had a lot of speed, Steve. And she broke out of the gate, fell on her head, was last. So I just sat on her, and she came and smoked them from last. So she's going to run back in the vagrancy. And, you know, there was a lot of conversation. Were they going to let me ride her or not? Because the apprentice doesn't get the weight allowance. And weight was a big issue back then. They really, you know, it's not like now people take overweight. You know, they didn't take overweight. If you didn't get the allowance, most of the time they would put a journeyman. So David McKibben, who owned her, and Steve DeMauro agreed to let me ride her. And I'm thinking in the vagrancy, she'll be up close. It was just that she stumbled out of the gate, right? Well, she broke on top and took herself back to last, and then she smoked them and gave me my first stakes winner, the vagrancy. And every time the vagrancy runs now, I think back to that, what a vote of confidence for an owner and a trainer to put you in that position, and then to have a filly that you had such a relationship with give you your first stake win, and also to illustrate how horses change. You know, horses, you know, they evolve sometimes and we don't evolve with them. She had speed. She decided she wanted to use it late in a race. And that year she was the experimental free highweight, which basically was the championship. They didn't have an Eclipse Award then for that. So she was Island Charm. My first stake winner was the vagrancy.
I love it. Well, I've got to get to a visit from Andrew Offerman, but I did want you to at least take a minute and talk about Flavien Prat's flashy entrance into the jocks room, including the natural hat trick on Saturday.
Yeah, listen, again, we've got a great colony here in New York. I mean, it's fun for me to watch, and it's such a great blend of youth and youthful exuberance and strength, and then, you know, some wily old veterans, and Flavien is, to me, a blend. Like, he's not on the lower end of the spectrum being young. He's still young. And, like, in the middle of that spectrum of that cagey, you know, wizened veteran, and he does everything right. Everything you watch him do, from how he positions his horses to, you know, those split-second decisions, whether you're going to stay in or, you know, find the clear, and then, you know, the way he is physically. I mean, it just added a whole nother layer of depth to this colony.
Rich Migliori, everybody. Meg, Preakness, don't know if you've had a chance to start looking, but if you got any ideas, you know, let me know.
Well, listen, Epicenter is going to be very tough, but I have to tell you, I was out the other morning. Like I said, I've been out a lot of mornings now.
Early
voting. And I watched early voting, and then I walked back to the barn with him. I was with Ernie Munich, who was taping him, you know, filming him to do a feature about it. And the way he came back out of the work was even more impressive than the work in the gallop out. He came back like it just whetted his appetite. I'm pretty bullish. He's going to run huge. They got the path to the winner's circle is through him.
There you go. Well, he's going to, as you say that, I see that Marcus Hirsch has put up a pace projector on the back of an envelope. So maybe I'll retweet that. I love it. Richie, this was great. I appreciate it. And we will be recapping Preakness Weekend next week.
I look forward to it, Steve, and I'll be in better voice.
You sound fine. Rich Migliori, everybody. There you go. Let's, Case, let's turn right around, because I know that Andrew Offerman, he's got a 10 o'clock Central Time interview as Canterbury Park. Let me turn to my Canterbury. There we go. Canterbury, a couple of stakes tomorrow, actually, as they get underway. And I'm anxious to kick off the season. So Canterbury conversation coming up. Top of the hour, Andy Serling. We'll check in with Popo later as well. And see how close we are to a, now that we've got this early, I love this early Monday, you know, big weekend draw. This is a lot of benefits to be had by drawing these weekends like this so far in advance. Canterbury was drawn and was ready to be perused. And I hear Andrew Offerman in the background. Andrew, I guess summer. I guess summer is here.
It's coming. It's been late arriving here, but it's made it.
But let's face it, it's always late arriving in Minnesota.
That is true.
Well, you've got the first few days of the season ready to go, and you know, you're over the last few years, as we've talked, it's so important to Canterbury to have the live gate, to have people. You've spent so much time cultivating really a live audience, and so as we get pandemic further in the rearview mirror, we can kind of anticipate a truly normal season at Canterbury.
Yeah, definitely. We're still obviously trying to work to maintain the interest of the horse player through a schedule that we hope is still kind of off the peak of the major racing circuits, but we're trying to do our best to put racing at a time that also makes it friendly to our on-track crowd. About the 6,000 plus that attended on a daily average basis before COVID. We want to try to get as many of them back in the building as possible. So a switch this year, a little tweak to a Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon program to continue to kind of play with our schedule a little bit to try to appease both sides is the goal, and I think we'll be successful. We experienced a lot more success from a handle perspective last year on the Sunday afternoons than I think a lot of us expected, so we're hopeful we can replicate that with this year's schedule this summer.
Let's lay it out, and it's a five-month season, May through September, and the, as you mentioned, the midweek portion will be Wednesdays and Thursdays, and post is 5 o'clock Central. And then the Saturday action also at 5, and then on Sundays, 1 o'clock. So adjust, people have to kind of adjust their thinking. It's an interesting way of approaching it, the hybrid weekend, weekday schedule. I like it.
Yeah, appreciate it. You know, our historical schedule that kind of ran on strictly weekends, we obviously never, as we've talked about before, really made headway into the national wagering scene like we wanted to. COVID changed that quite a bit. And giving us the ability to kind of play with our schedule in ways that we wouldn't have otherwise been able to, I think has gotten us to a point where our racing is kind of seeing the recognition that hopefully it deserves nationally, and it still gives us an opportunity now to look at what we do on track and try to make sure that we're keeping the racing fan here locally interested and able to attend the races. So we're excited about kind of this year's tweaks and the ability to bring Saturday night racing back for the local fan and yet still hopefully appease that national audience by finding a time that's kind of off-peak on Saturday evenings.
Talk about some of the events and some of the key dates on the schedule. We should note you are going to run July 4th on the Monday. So that week, instead of running on Wednesday the 6th, you put on a special July 4th card.
Yeah, exactly. So one special holiday card on that July 4th afternoon, specific to kind of our significant events, our racing events, kind of bunch all of our stakes races into groups throughout the course of the meet. So we actually kick off a week from opening day on Wednesday with three turf races that are all preps for Mystic Lake Derby Day, Mystic Lake Northern Stars Festival Day, which comes up on Wednesday, June 22nd. Wednesday, June 22nd, we hope to replicate kind of some of the success that we had last summer when we set a handle record on that day. They features all of our significant stakes races, like I mentioned, the Mystic Lake Mile. Got four separate turf stakes and six stakes total that afternoon. So that will be our biggest day of the season. And then we have three separate Minnesota Bred stakes days kind of throughout the rest of the summer. July the 16th is our Hall of Fame night, where we induct our local Hall of Fame members into our Hall of Fame and have preps for the three-year-old races, major Minnesota Bred three-year-old races. August 13th, the Minnesota Oaks and Derby for the best state bred 3-year-old, and then Saturday, September 10th, is Festival of Champions, which features all of our Minnesota Divisional Championship races. So those are our major racing days over the course of the summer. And then we are again hosting a major tournament, the Big Ten BCBC, that will take place on Thursday, September 15th. That is our closing week Thursday, second to last day of the meet, where we typically put on significant cards, big field size, 12 or 13 races, and this year an opportunity to win one of 10 BCBC qualifying seats in an exciting format featured on some really wide open racing their closing weekend.
Really nice. Well, tell people to visit CanterburyPark.com. There is a lot going on. And then there's even things away from the race days. You got a concert calendar where the track becomes a concert venue, mostly Fridays, and that looks fabulous. Let's talk about the betting menu, because one of the reasons that horse players have adopted Canterbury Park, going back to the to the low takeout experiment, you've absolutely gone out of your way wagering innovation and I mean, let's be honest, cut rate in terms of takeout. Talk about the way the betting menu will greet players, including the new Pick 4 concept. Another 10% takeout play.
Sure. So you kind of hit the nail right on the head there. That's the headline for the year, the post time pick four starting in race one. Every day, a 10% takeout wager, trying to draw attention to our first race every single day throughout the course of the meet, make sure that people understand when our post time is, and try to give them a reason to tune in early every single racing day to play the lowest takeout pick four in the country. That backs up on the second half of the card with the return of the 10% takeout pick five, something that we had a lot of success with over the course of the pandemic, that continued to grow last year and that we're hoping continues to succeed here in 2022. So those are kind of the two horizontal staples. The rest of our wagering format's pretty traditional. No jackpot bets, just the two lowest takeout pick four and pick five wagers in the country.
Really nice. And typically, in terms of race count, we got eight. I know we've got eight race card to open up. So we're like eight during the week, and maybe nine on the weekends.
Yeah, we'll be eight or nine every day. Our entries were a little bit slow for opening day, just based on how bad our weather had been this spring and people being a little bit slow in preparation for the year. But we should be at eight or nine races every day throughout the season.
How much did Oaklawn's late finish? It's not late. It's their new policy. It's their new calendar. Did that delay the arrival of some horses?
For sure. You know, historically, pre-COVID, we had opened on Kentucky Derby Day. And, you know, with us drawing horses from Arizona, Tampa, Oaklawn, really all of those meets ending on Kentucky Derby weekend had just made it difficult to get people here and be able to, you know, be in a position where they could split their help and split their stables. So moving back kind of as a result of COVID and as a result of those changes to Preakness Week, I think has helped us get ready, and it certainly still is a challenge for people kind of moving across the country in the span of 10 days. But our horse count went over 1,000 yesterday. We still expect about 1,300 horses here by the end of the month. So we should have a good summer and be able to fill races here once we get through the first couple of weeks, which are always a little bit tricky coming out of the dead of winter.
And you'll get some from Fauna, right? As well, that will turn up
for sure. Not a substantial number, probably 100 or so, but yeah, their meet running the extra couple of weeks has delayed a couple of those individuals' arrival here as well. So I think we did an okay job filling races here the first few days of the season, but I expect that will get better over the course of the summer.
Well, the 10,000 Lakes and the Lady Slipper on this opening card, I guess we can call it a night, opening night card, 6:10 Eastern is late enough to make it a let's see, last post is 8:40 Central. So it really, for those of us on the East Coast, it's certainly a night-ish card, right? You know what's going to help? I think you're going to benefit from a little bit. How about on the Wednesday, Thursday, the fact that Presque Isle has abandoned that late afternoon, early evening slot?
Yeah, you know, we had historically been a night signal even when we ran during the week, and we've really found, I think, a lot of success kind of in that late afternoon spot. So that part's been enjoyable. We've really benefited from kind of that late afternoon post time.
Well, there we go. Casey, I think that was you in Florida, I think, may have had an issue. No? Did we get Andrew back?
I'm here.
I don't think so. Oh, you are there. Okay. I think something happened on the studio in Florida. I was talking about the stakes action, the 10,000 and 10,000 Lakes and the Lady Slipper. Anybody that new to the Canterbury scene, or is it a lot of the most? I see a lot of familiar names.
Yeah, the stakes races on opening night always bring out kind of the normal names that people are used to seeing at the top of the division. There is kind of a cool storyline in that in the Lady Slipper, Ready to Runaway, is chasing several different Minnesota-bred earnings records that she has a chance to eclipse over the course of this season. So a strong season puts her in a position to be the winningest horse of all time, Minnesota-bred horse of all time here, which is kind of a cool storyline as the season goes on. And, as far as the people are concerned, a lot of the same trainers return. I think all but one of the top 10 trainers return. We've got several new faces that are anticipated to be here, including Miguel Hernandez, Van Belvoir, Jonathan Wong has a small string up here this summer. And Lynn Kleberad's sending a string of turf horses for the summer, so I expect that as entries continue that they'll add some additional intrigue to the handicapping. And our jockey colony kind of experienced a pretty substantial turnover as compared to prior years, with Rye Eckleberry keeping his tack down at Lone Star this summer, Alex Conchari deciding to ride at Prairie Meadows, and the retirement of Quincy Hamilton and Dean Butler took five of the top 10 riders from the last couple of meets out. So there are some new faces in the rider colony, including Jermaine Bridgemahan, Ezekiel Lara, and Harry Hernandez, one of the leadingest riders in the country who comes from Turf Paradise and has a really strong book of rides for opening week. So a little bit of turnover there, so should create a little bit of a change in some of the dynamics that the wagering public will see this summer.
Excellent. Well, Shakopee, of course, Canterbury Park will be checking in regularly and handicapping. I do want to also give a nod to the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project, and there's information on the website, Andrew, because they've done a terrific job hosting people and trying to get people to the track and get involved in ownership. Happy to give them some attention. It's a great initiative.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And we're definitely trying to do what we can to cultivate horse ownership and try to find different ways for people to engage in the sport. And, you know, we're not often thought about, I think, as a destination venue and horse racing. But for those of your listeners that enjoy kind of a live racing experience and maybe want to see something a little bit different, encourage them to see if they can fit us into their travel plans. Getting on track with 5,000 or 6,000 people, especially on a nice summer evening, is a pretty cool experience that is difficult to kind of replicate amongst, similar mid-tier racetracks around the country. And we obviously got, all sorts of other things going on with Major League Sports in the city. So for the sports and racing fan, come check us out. I think you'll enjoy it.
Well, and if you aren't following MN Racehorse, you can follow them on Twitter, racehorseminnesota.com for all the information, and canterburypark.com for everything you need to know. And if you've got any travel coming up through Minnesota and up toward the Twin Cities, try to make a day at least for Canterbury Park this summer. Andrew Offerman, best of luck, safe meet for everybody, and we'll check in with you regularly. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
There it is, the opening action tomorrow and Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday for Canterbury Park, that really tries so hard and has been the most, along with Indiana, has been just so proactive trying to attract and respect the horse player with the takeout structure. And, they had an incredibly noble experiment. Now it's probably, 6-7 years ago. But, the experiment to slash takeout. And they did grow their handle, like 8%. But the problem with that experiment, you'll remember as we discussed at the time, unless there's a widespread attempt to bring takeout down industry-wide, there's really no way to track the impact, because getting more money back on your bets at Canterbury, there's no guarantee, of course, that you're going to just plow everything back into Canterbury. The beauty of this era of horseplay is that we can bet on anything, anytime, anywhere. So unless there's a widespread application of the attempt to bring takeout down industry-wide, anecdotally, it's impossible to make the the clear case. I mean, we know that lowering takeout increases handle because it puts more money into our pockets as players, and that increases churn. Everybody, every part of the infrastructure, every part of the ecosystem benefits. But it was such a noble thing for them to try, Randy Sampson and the Sampson family at Canterbury. And so instead they've gone forward with things like this 10% pick five, which is the last five races of the day, and then introducing this 10% pick four to draw attention to the start of the cards. So 6 o'clock, 6:10, first post on the weekdays, and 5 o'clock on the weekends, Canterbury Park. Let's take a break. Second of the morning. We'll come back for hour three. Andy Serling's going to check in. I got a few things I want Andy to talk about, including the performance of We the People in the Peter Pan, and we'll probably get some Preakness thoughts from Andy too. I'm sure he's already looked at the card. Back after this, hour three, live from Old Hilltop. Hi ho, stay with us.
Horse racing, Naira Betts. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions, and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Betts. $200 deposit match with promo Steve 200. Visit Naira Betts.